So this is interesting for me. It's the first time that I've taught the sutras anyway. When Asha taught this book, she did book study. Of course, it's a different approach, but this is the book. It's little. It took her 2 years. 2 years, exactly, to get through the book. I've listened to about the first 8 of those talks. I've never gotten through all of them yet, though I always plan to in the seclusion. And then Jyotish and Devi actually gave a week-long course on Patanjali, and there's 10 hours of recording with frequent comments about how they're just able to touch.
Is it on YouTube? Is it worth
it? You know, I don't know. I have it on a flash drive, but you can get it through Treasures. Mm. You can ask Krishna. Yeah, it's a great class. But I do want to say this. I don't know about anybody else's relationship to the sutras, but because I started studying Hatha Yoga when I was quite young and was dabbling in a lot of spiritual paths long before I found Ananda, you know, you can't do any of that without hearing about Patanjali. Because, of course, Patanjali is not a religion, and we'll talk about that. Patanjali is sort of just stating a truth, an eternal truth that says no matter what path you're on, it doesn't matter what religion you're a part of, if your goal is to realize your relationship with the divine, if your goal is to get to know your true nature, I mean, even if you don't know what that means, but if you've set foot on a spiritual path, if you're inclined that way, you will go through these stages of development. And it doesn't matter whether you're doing through the Catholic Church or if you're Jewish or if you're a self-realizationist, which is what we would call ourselves. You will, in order to get to that fully realized place, you will go through these stages. Mm-hmm. And then his teachings have really been confirmed, restated, by many avatars since then. And you can see this extraordinary and very clear once you've studied them. For instance, relationship with the Bhagavad Gita. Even right down to the fact that in the Gita, things, and we're not going to talk about this aspect of it, but you know the five good brothers who represent each of the chakras and those upward lifting qualities that take us to God. Each one of the chakras that they represent also represents part of the Eightfold Path. So for instance, Arjuna, who is represented by the third chakra, fiery self-determination, willpower, it's everything Arjuna was. That chakra is related to the stage called asana. Here I wrote the Eightfold Path. So the stories are the same, the lessons are the same, and for those of us here who are now listening to these readings from the Bible every week and who have read Swamiji's book said that we probably understand the Bible better than we ever did. Mm-hmm. We know those teachings are exactly the same. So every avatar that's come after Patanjali, which Krishna did, which Jesus did, Moses did, all of these avatars are really confirming everything Patanjali wrote, though you would think that they represent all different religions. So why I started to say this, though, is that, and this doesn't prove anything or mean anything, I'm simply sharing my experience with you. I never understood a word of what was Patanjali's teachings.
I'm so glad you said
it. I knew not what word. And I will say, and I realize this, I'll tell you the truth, I feel very humble teaching this class. I mean, I feel like, really, for this whole week I've been saying, what possessed me to say yes when they asked me to teach it? Because, you know, to teach something perfectly well, you have to know it. You almost have to be it to be able to just get up and the way we like to teach, I mean, with inspiration and extemporaneously, so that we feel we're not teaching, but rather these masters are speaking through us. It either takes an enormous amount of grace, which I've been praying for this whole week, or having such an extraordinary knowledge, knowing these teachings, that it just flows. And I just wasn't there. And I've listened to them a lot now, but I never understood a word of it. Part of it for me is that because I don't take an intellectual approach to anything, it's simply not my way, which is, you know, all wrapped up the way karma is. I did not come in this lifetime to be a Buddhist who has to learn about this many folds here, this many things here. It's always sounded like a science to me, even though I actually love Buddhist teachings when they're explained at a more heart level. I could never be drawn there. And Patanjali has a lot of that. If you read that book, I just read some of them, but as soon as I heard Eightfold Path, you know, it could turn me off. And then the yamas and the niyamas and the vrittis and the obstacles and the accommodations, he calls, you know, another list. He's got so many lists just in these few aphorisms. So I think it was very hard for me. But here's what I'll tell you, an interesting thing. I woke up at 4 o'clock this morning to meditate and to sort of frantically read over a few notes. And that's the feeling I was having. And I picked up this book, and I read the book at 4 o'clock this morning. And I totally understood the book. It was the most... I had taken this book with me on so many... This book was published in 2013, 4 years ago. Now, most people in this path know Swamiji doesn't usually write a book that most of us haven't read 4 years later. I've not been able to read the book. But I read the book this morning, and I thought to myself, if I just stood up here and read the aphorisms, you know, it goes through 4 books, and so I didn't add up. I think there's 194. Thank you. Couple left here the other day. I was talking to him and he said, I'm going home to read the
title. I read the book, but I know that.
You know that. Did you read the book? Because I might need your help here.
No, I haven't read the book.
Okay.
But I've listened to other, like, there's so many talks, and I've been to other places, and so it's a very popular teaching. Not popular, but very common teaching. So, yeah, I've been in other classes, so I know there are 194.
There's 194 aphorisms. If I stood here now, and I thought to myself this morning, is it just in me? Because, you know, we all know this. You can pick up any book, any spiritual book, or you could read this book over and over, depending on where you are spiritually and your own spiritual development. It's not understanding. It's how have we really, really, in essence, I was just going to say, how have we really grown spiritually? But the truth is, in a certain way, how much are we living completely in terms of these yamas and niyamas, which, of course, we get closer and closer and closer if we're serious and committed on a path. And we'll talk about what these are so we don't have to guess. But this whole thing is a roadmap. So if we've been serious on the path, you know, let's hope that I'm not where I was when I was 30 years old. So I've come some way, whatever that is. And suddenly I could pick up this book. And it was really like a revelation just this morning. And I'm saying it all to you because I don't want to stand up here and pretend to be anything I'm not. This whole week I've just been trying to devour stuff I got online. You know, you just find anything online these days. And I just was Googling Patanjali. First of all, I wanted to find out what is the definition of an aphorism. You know, I was asking myself these things. What do they mean by sutra? What does that word mean? What do we know about Patanjali? And so it turns out we really don't know much about Patanjali. We don't even really know when he lived. We don't even really know what he wrote and what he didn't write, except for these sutras. And aphorism just means really bringing a truth down to its the essence of what it is. So anyway, I didn't find out much that way. But there are so many teachers teaching about Patanjali Sutras of mine. So I tried listening to about three of them. And I got about 5 minutes in. You know, attunement is really extraordinary. When you are attuned to a certain vibration and you're used to hearing and learning and receiving, and these are the teachers who are supposed to teach you, I just thought, how does anybody listen to this man or that person? And then I said, because that person has disciples too, and they're exactly attuned to him. So the internet was no good for me. It didn't work. Okay, so we'll do whatever we do today. Now we have 2.5 hours. We'll get to whatever we get to. At some point, no matter where I am, I'm going to stop and talk about the yamas and niyamas, only because they certainly are the most applicable to everyday life part of the sutra. I mean, all of it is, but I think for probably where most of us are. Now, I say that, but I realize that even when we're talking about internalizing the mind, when we're talking about developing deep concentration, you know, I mean, we'll talk about what these all mean. Many of us in here, we're people who meditate a lot. Probably some of you meditate rather deeply. So I think even these later stages that are much more subtle, but I think they are applicable. I mean, I'm by no means writing off. We were talking just before about names being Sanskrit names as we take them. And I think even in India, people name their children these names with some awareness that this is what they'll be calling them every day of their life, and they become an affirmation for these different qualities. But I was thinking about the people on our path who we know. When I've been studying it, there's a woman who really runs our center in Gurgaon, whose name is Diana. She's been on this path for years, and I thought, no wonder Swamiji gave her the name of Diana. I mean, complete absorption in the divine, and it just feels like her, you know. And you could just look at some of these people. It was interesting. I mean, because names that aren't up here that are the Sanskrit words for some of the aphorisms that Swamiji alludes to every once in a while. So I got to see, oh, that's why Santoshi's called Santoshi, or this. You know, you could just see where the intuition came from for Swamiji. So I'd like to start a little bit just at the beginning. Most of, I think, what I'll share, some of us know, but you can't just start right in the middle of this extraordinary topic. It would make no sense, I mean, even for us, just for a flow here. And then, as I said, depending on how time goes, we'll at least for sure go through the yamas and the niyamas. When Asha taught this course for the YTT class, she taught, there's 2 days where there are lectures on Patanjali, and of course we asked her to give those after she just spent 2 years teaching it. But she told a story of having a friend at the village who put the yamas, which mean the don'ts, mean these are the things that we try not to do, and we'll talk about this later, why we do that. So these are the do's and the don'ts, or really the don'ts and the do's, as they're always presented in this order, on her refrigerator. And every time, and she was raising 8 children, I got the feeling from how Asha said that they were maybe not all her biological children, though they could have been. I don't know, she didn't mention who it was, and it didn't matter. But she was responsible for raising 8 children. And every time there would be a skirmish amongst the kids, or one of the children was having a problem, they would go over to the refrigerator and they would try and figure out, okay, where are you off? What's happening here? How are you not living in terms of the yamas and niyamas? And she said every one of their life experiences could relate back to this. And I can say that as I was reading and studying these a little bit this week, I could get that. So it's important to come back there. You know, these are called, of course, the Yoga Sutras. I mean, that's what they're called. So we're really looking at this question of what is yoga. Now, we know that what we're aiming for on this path is really that state of yoga. Because yoga, and again, many misnomers in the world, there are so many people around who have never known of any type of yoga except Hatha yoga. And they may... and they may only know of Hatha yoga through one of these yogas that are being taught now that are basically calisthenics. So the word yoga is being used a lot that people don't understand. But yoga, we all know, means union. And it really is our goal. It means living in that pure, super conscious reality that is part of, includes all that is. It's beyond time, space. It's certainly beyond all of our self-definitions. It's beyond every quality that we took on as that aspect of spirit, like the small aspect of spirit that we each are, the individualized aspect, at the moment of conception, when that part, when our soul became identified with the body, from that very moment, everything about our life has been dualistic in nature. Because from that moment, everything has an outward-facing quality to it. It's part of the human condition. It's not bad. It is not a bad thing. And I know, again, most of us have heard this and we know it. Because as it came to me just about, I don't know, less than a year ago, because the ego has such a bad sound on the spiritual path. We're always trying to get away from the ego. But the ego is the soul itself identified with the body. So it's not a bad thing. It's part of the soul. It's how we use it, what direction we move in with it, the lessons we're able to learn from it that really make all the difference in and of itself. It doesn't have a good or a bad quality. And furthermore, it needs this vehicle. We have to be in a human condition to be able to find our way back to our original state, back to that state, our true reality. You know, we can call it whatever we want, but it's so beyond how most of us think of ourselves all the time. And this path is showing us this is what you'll do. You'll go through all of these stages. So Patanjali starts, the first aphorism says, and now we come to the study of the science of yoga. That's just how he starts. That's how his book starts, and now we come to it. And, again, I'm aware a lot of you have read this before and studied it, but as Swamiji said, he's rarely read an interpretation before where anybody pays attention to the word now. What does it mean? And now we come. And he explains it in terms of the three, what we call philosophies, but he quickly says that's an English word that means the love of wisdom. And he's saying these three philosophies, Shankhya, Yoga, Vedanta. So Shankhya tells us why we would want to be learning, growing, becoming anything other than how we find ourselves in human condition, and basically describes the whole nature of suffering in the world, the threefold nature of suffering, that we suffer at a physical, mental, and spiritual level. So Shankhya philosophy presents all of that, and what Patanjali is saying, once you know that this world of duality, this world that you've chosen to enter for good reason, is going to cause you nothing but pain. It simply cannot. When Devi talks about this, she very cutely says, I won't get her story exactly right, but she said, in reading all of what she's read for years, for those of you who don't know Devi, both Jyotish and Devi are very, very smart people. I mean, intellectually smart. And they study that way in college, and their whole life they're still that way. I mean, they go deep with trying to understand these things, literally at the mind level. She said as a young woman, she was always reading a lot of these different philosophies, and she kept coming across these words, sukha and dukkha, but she never understood what they meant until she got into studying the Gita. And then she realized she came across this phrase, sukha dukkha dukkha, and she realized that it meant a world, because sukha means pleasure, dukkha means pain, and this constant world of pleasure and pain, and that they are inextricably connected. And that's the nature of duality. And I just have to say this to all of you, but I certainly don't want to spend, again, because this is in some ways basic to all of us, and I know that. But that for every pleasure that we ever experience, there has to be a pain. And for every painful way that we take ourselves, whatever it is, when we try and entertain any degree of negativity or overindulgence, we're just taking ourselves further and further away from this center. Pleasure and pain have to add up to zero, because zero in this case, in this spiritual world that we're talking about, it means oneness. It means the one. It means neutrality. So for every pleasure, there's a pain, and for every pain, there will be a pleasure, until we find ourselves really resting right in our astral spine, and not even just in the astral spine, which has in and of itself an inherent duality, because it has the irda, which is rising up, and the pingala, which is then downward. So those energies themselves have to come in and neutralize in this spine that has kundalini at the base of the spine. I'm saying a lot of words, but I'm just trying to create an image for you. And this thousandfold lotus at the top of this astral spine, and we have to get into the middle of that somehow to get out of this world of sukha dukkha dham. And that's the whole goal. That's the goal of yoga. That's what yoga means. Yoga means, it's not even a path. Yoga means being right in that spine, in that place, which is here, which gets, I'm not going to start there, that's for sure, the hardest place to talk about, because there is no sense of I, there is no sense of effort, there is no sense of me, there is no better, worse, good, bad, because we've transcended all of it. So when Patanjali says, and now we come to the study of the science of yoga, he is acknowledging that people would only embark on this study, again, no matter what path it is, once they have come to understand that the world is nothing but suffering. That ultimately, as long as we live in terms of the, not just the material world, but a mental world, and it even comes up spiritually, because people have so many misconceptions of what spirituality means. And furthermore, we're always trying to get to move on all of these eight limbs, not in a linear way. We can't do it that way. It's not like once we get all of the yamas down, then we'll move on to the niyamas, because in a fascinating, extraordinarily subtle way, you can't possibly get the yamas perfected if you don't have all of the rest of it perfected as well. They are interconnected and interactive, even though we speak of it as a linear. But you'll see this when we talk a little bit about what it means to, when we talk, for instance, about pranayama, it's almost the most obvious there. Because you talk about trying to control energy, which is really what pranayama means, the control of energy. But you can't control energy if your mind isn't calm. And your mind cannot be calm unless it's interiorized. And it just goes on and on. So you see You're just moving towards this goal with this whole eight limb path, a part of it, surrounding it, you're indulging yourself in all of it, you're moving in terms of all of it, until it comes just like this, into a state of oneness. But you don't do one without the other. So again, they are interactive, but nobody would be motivated to do this, because the this challenges everything that draws us as a human being. It's ridiculous how hard it is to do all of this. Why would anybody do it? Nobody does this until they realize, and even once they realize they're suffering. I have a very dear friend who I love dearly, who she attends a lot of different spiritual things, and she always wants to be growing spiritually. But she always makes decisions that are about pleasure, no matter what it is. It's hard to describe. So I said to her, you know, we're going on this pilgrimage in November. It would be really great for you to go. Because a couple years ago, I led a pilgrimage to Italy, and she wanted to go, and I wouldn't let her go. Because I said, no, this is a pilgrimage for people who are meditating long hours. We're going to do that a lot. You won't want to do that. You want to sightsee. You want to shop. It's not what it's about. But I said to her, come to L.A. And I've been telling her, L.A., L.A., L.A. It's a perfect pilgrimage for her. So yesterday I texted her and I said, I'm trying to finalize this. How many rooms we need. And I need to know now. Are you going to go or not? She said, oh, you know I really need that pilgrimage. But I decided that I should go to the East Coast and be with my friends for Thanksgiving, and that's 10 days later. And how could I go away both times? And I wrote her back. I decided to push against it a little bit. And I said, you know, it's lovely that you're going to the East Coast. I think you were just there 3 weeks ago, right? She writes me back in. I said, this is food for your soul. She said, oh, I desperately need food for my soul. But I think I'll have to pass this time. But and I get it. I'm not making fun of her. I'm really not. She is not in a place where she could make a different decision. She cannot. But you can see, here's somebody who so wants that. Now, we're all like that. That's why pointing up, it's just an easy story to tell, and it just happened yesterday. And, you know, I mean, I could tell one of five stories that happened yesterday. Some of them on myself, because I was sitting with another friend the other night, and we were talking about the draw of blaming somebody else for what's going on in your life. And those people are really behaving badly. I mean, they are. You could bring in a whole jury. They would say these people are behaving badly. And I have a situation like this going on in my life right now. So as I was talking to her, I said to her, I'm telling you all this, but I have the same thing. It's so seductive to want to go with what we know. It's so seductive to say to somebody, can you believe she did this to me? And they'll go, you're kidding. That is terrible. Why do you take that? And most of the world, this is what most of the world does. So we, if we want to work through these things, which we can hardly see ourselves, because then my ego says, I really am being mistreated. And this is really hard, what I've been given to do. I still have to rise up and serve and look like everything's okay, but this person's being mean to me. And then I can spend a long time, if I'm not careful, really careful, blaming her. Because it looks that way. It's so subtle. It looks that way. And there's a lot of justification for it in the world. I'm saying all of this to you to say why Patanjali, and you know, why Patanjali had to say now. Because even now, this is a challenge. It is such a challenge to us. And I'm telling you examples of where I saw it and where I could catch it and where I could say to myself, Shanti, why is this in your life? What could you learn? Swami always says when somebody criticizes you, thank them. You try that sometimes. That is not easy. And here's another thing. If they don't mean all that much to you, very easy to do that. Oh, you're so upset with me. Tell me. I want to hear. I've done that 1,000 times. People look at me, they go, really? Yeah, tell me exactly what you think I've done wrong. And I mean it. I do want to hear, and I will learn. But family, my husband, somebody who has a little power over me, not so easy for it. And you could be many years down the road before you realize that you've just wasted decades of your life doing this. And again, it's not to be critical of ourselves, because where is that? No, sorry. It's over here. Because one of the neons is self-study, introspection. It's part of the human condition, of course. But it's something we have to practice and do. Getting to know ourselves honestly, openly. Ego, get thee behind me. You know, as Swami says. But I'm saying it to you to say, these are highly evolved. These are from an avatar. They are right at the core. That's what they're called, aphorisms. And here's another thing. There is not 1 ounce of fat in these teachings. Not 1 ounce of fat. You go to underline this book, and guess what? The whole book is underlined. And I mean it other than prepositions or the whole book. So I do it first in yellow, then I do it in green. I happen to know B. Raj uses these little stickies, and each page will have literally, I won't exaggerate, 100 stickies on it. Why? 50? I mean, really? There's a lot. I borrowed books from him. Because the more you see, that's why, and I first read the Raja Yoga book, which I want to say to you all, I don't know, most of you have taken Raja, some of you have not. Swamiji, that book is absolutely brilliant. It is absolutely brilliant. And if it's been a while since you've read it again, because that's the experience I had. So I just sat down with it, first of all, because we're rewriting the Raja course and I'm going to be teaching a lot of it. So I really wanted to understand his approach. But he takes every meaningful aspect of yoga, of this life experience that we have, taking us back to our nature. And again, every word he says, crystal clear and right to the core of what is meant by all of this. It's unbelievable. Between these two books, this is what happens when these great masters are teaching us. But then you start realizing every single word is important. Every sentence, you feel like, I felt, I could contemplate this for a lifetime. This sentence, I mean. Mm-hmm. And I really do mean it. So we're not talking about this in any way today to blame ourselves, to be hard on ourselves. I realize how important this aspect of self-study and introspection is, because we're all here because we want to grow spiritually. Every one of us. We would not be here today if we didn't. And you know, this is a funny analogy, but it just came through my mind, because most of you know, I'm a physician. Before I was a physician, I was a nurse for 14 years. I've been around patients a lot, and I grew up in the era when natural childbirth was the thing. It was really the thing. If you were a serious mother, you did not get anesthesia, you didn't do anything. You went through natural childbirth. And I don't know when this room has had a child, but it's not easy. It's like really not easy. So what I found in those days is that they took all of these classes. Lamaze was a big thing, but whatever it was. And you know, everybody said, look, women have been doing this for centuries, really for thousands of years. No, they just drop their babies in the field. It's nothing. You know, this is what you learn in these courses. So when the time comes and you're actually delivering that baby, if you run into a lot of trouble with it, the guilt is enormous. And it shadows the entire birth experience for women. I watched it over and over. And my role, which was not supposed to be my role, but I would be there with them telling them, you're perfect just as you are. This is absolutely fine. You've loved your child. You've given it your best. It is not a failure. You know, really, I was telling them the same kinds of thing I could say to people right now about our spiritual path. If we're not mindful, we hold ourselves to Patanjali's standards, and soon we can't stand it and we leave the path one way or another, because there's a good chance that most of us in this room are not going to make it to here in this lifetime. There's a chance we could, every one of us could, but probably at least a couple of us won't, and I'll put myself in that category. You know, this takes millions of lifetimes. We know that. And it takes millions of lifetimes. This is another thing that Jyoti Shundevi mentioned in their course on Patanjali. When Devi's actually looking, as she speaks about, and now we come to the practice, other than the now in terms of the philosophies, the Shankhya, the yoga, and then the Veda that says the what, this is what it is. The yoga that we're talking about, Patanjali's yoga, is the how. The Vedanta is, here it is, this is what it is. That's why it's so darn hard to read. But anyway, fortunately, we don't have to talk about that today. We're just on that now. But she says, we could also just consider for each of us, and I think this is very useful, and now we come to the study, she said, because it's taken us millions of lifetimes, this individual soul, to get to the human condition. And once we get to the human condition, we come into some unique states that insects, rocks, crystals, animals don't necessarily have. And among that is free will. And free will is an interesting opportunity to be given, because it means we get to make choices. And what we all probably know, even just from this lifetime, is that we get the freedom to make choices. Sometimes we make good choices, and sometimes we make bad choices. And what do those words really mean? What is a good choice? I mean, we in here want to talk about a good choice is anything that takes us in the direction of yoga. Anything that takes us there. A bad choice is when we decide to, not just as we always talk about it, pay attention to downward pulling, outward pulling energy. Not just, you know, what are we going to do with our next vacation? Am I going to go back to Mexico again with my girlfriends who sit on the beach for 4 days around mostly unclad people and who never once, my friends, mention God, and who do not a lot of drinking, like bad drinking, but they're drinking all the time. And that's what I do for 4 days, to look at the Caribbean because it's beautiful. Or when is the year in my life when I say to them, we've been doing this for 25 years, but I can't do it anymore. I can't spend the time, the energy, the money. I don't want to be there. I don't want to be in that energy. I'm going to the village this year. I'm going to use that week and do seclusion. Now, was it bad of me to go to Mexico all those years? Of course not. If somebody had tried to say to me, you go to the village and do seclusion, that would have been horrible for me. I would have rebelled. It could have taken me right off the path. Or I could have decided that I hate the village and that I hate seclusion. Because we just have to know, where are we? So again, we use these words that have so many connotations, good, bad, out, in. But we need to be very careful. You know, because it might just be that going to Mexico and being able to sit lovingly with two very good and old friends and support them and feed them the way only I could feed them. They're not going to feed each other that way. that might have been a real step up for me for many years. That was probably helping me karmically. And so, you know, at some point, what was an upward lifting energy, suddenly you realize it's either holding you where you are or it's pulling you down. Swami's master said a very interesting thing to Swamiji, though. These are all related to these teachings, but I'm just sharing these things with you. I'm not, you know, hooking them on any one of these. If I had different color stickies, I could put them right with the lesson that they made. I never criticize you. I tease you a little, but I get it. Believe me. I'm telling you, Ashen 1 year bought me a gift. She looked at my calendar in the days of paper calendar, and she said to me, "I can't believe that you do this." So you all, most of you in this room know, I lead an extremely full life. And I've always, it's my karma, I have a very full life. So any day on a calendar probably has 12 to 14 things to do on it. Well, I color-coded my calendars, of course. What would any other good Virgo do? I color-coded. Asha went out and bought me the biggest set of color pencils. She wouldn't do that in a million years. Not only that, if something was on my calendar and it didn't happen, this is totally irrelevant, by the way, but if it was on my calendar and it didn't happen, Caitlin, shake your head, if I can show it, I would erase it. I mean, I could just move on to the next day. Who cares? I couldn't bear to have it on the calendar. Anyway, Master said to Swamiji once, when Swamiji...
I'm wiping out.
Actually, that's what I did. I said to Asha, oh, she said, "What's this white out about?" I said, "Well, I didn't get to those things." We were, she could only laugh so hard because we were, and interestingly, it is really very important. Interestingly, this has very much to do with the yama of nonviolence. I'm not actually totally obsessional about things, and it's a very good quality. That's what I've come to see. Because nonviolence includes much more than what we think. We all heard about it because of Gandhi. But keeping a really messy place and disorder and treating the environment and yourself that way, it's an act of violence, actually. So it is one of the yamas to keep order and neatness. I mean, again, it can go off the other end. But when that whole thing happened, when she saw my calendar, we were at Nancy's, I forget her spiritual name now, the gardener and cook.
Nivriti?
Yeah, not
Nivriti.
I don't remember. Maybe it is Nivriti. I was thinking of Nivriti. Anyway, a very dear friend of Asha's who's a great cook. She wrote that whole first Ananda cookbook with Asha, and she's a beautiful gardener. She just makes beauty. So every year she would make Swamiji's birthday cake. And I got invited to make the birthday cake to be one of the helpers. Why did I get invited? Because my calendar was... Asha knew that I would pay close attention to detail and not make a mistake with the cake. So she couldn't tease me too much in front of Nancy. Was her English name? I can't remember her name right now. But anyway, Master said to Swamiji once, when Swamiji said to him, "You know, I'd like you to help me because I'm drawn to a desire to eat good food, and I'd like to let go of that desire." And Master just said to him, "Don't even think about it." He said, "When higher consciousness comes, these desires just leave you." And you know, it's actually really true. I've heard the phrase, and I don't know, maybe it was in relation to when we leave our bodies. And hopefully we'll all leave our bodies in the direction of a good, what's called loka, these different levels that we can go to. You know, not everybody goes to the same place. We'd get a little crowded if that happened, but depending on how you've lived, you go wherever you need to go karmically as you leave. But I think it was in relation to that when Swamiji was describing that once, and he said, it's like desiring stale cheese when there's a whole banquet and feast waiting for you. He said it's just that different. So I think our job is not, because it's impossible, it's a virtual impossibility to try and stamp out every quality of ourselves, every aspect of ourselves that takes us in the direction of ego, of of contraction, of confinement, of wanting to hold on to everything we know, the more we're moving in the direction of increased awareness, which is really what this is. I mean, awareness becomes a very meaningful word in terms of Patanjali Sutras, and Swamiji uses it a lot. But as we're increasing our awareness, suddenly, you know, and I asked myself for 2 or 3 years, what am I doing coming to Mexico? What am I? And then finally it just became clear, and I could say to them, look guys, I really love you, and I know this is really going to be hard for you, but I don't want to come with you anymore. I didn't even say I can't. I just said I don't want to. Nothing in me can take myself there. And it just felt absolutely right. It was that way for me with alcohol because I loved wine. I was never a big drinker. I mean, it was never a problem for me. But I just couldn't imagine, why would people go out for a nice dinner and not have a glass? To me, going out was as much the wine as the food. I love holding a glass of wine. I love pouring wine. And it was just the end of the whole thing. And I tried a long time after I came onto this path. One time I stopped for a whole year. And then I still went back and had wine again. I was never an alcoholic. Maybe 2 glasses of wine a week. But I loved that it was so seductive, you know? And that's what, part of what we don't realize about a lot of this, part of why it's hard to let go of, and this is what makes it subtle in a way, is that we are not, until we get willing to own and to tell ourselves, now again, we have to work through all of this. I mean, contentment is an extraordinarily important to be actually at peace with exactly what you have now and not to think that you need something else in your life. This is how Master said, what comes of itself, let it come. It was very important when he said that. So again, I'll come back to all of these in some detail, but I'm alluding to it. But this introspection is so important because, do you think that it's easy to say to yourself when you're being really critical of somebody and feeling angry at them and gossiping about them, even if it's only in your mind, it's as bad as if you're doing it out loud to the world, even if it's only in your mind, how hard it is to say, I'm a little addicted to this. I'm actually enjoying this. Because it lets us off such a huge hook of looking at what we need to look at. Why is this person in my life right now? What is here for me to learn? Not an easy thing to do. It is so much easier until a certain point to criticize others, to see what's wrong, to just go out and have sex with one more person because it calms you down a little. You start feeling restless and you think you'll just buy something new, which a lot of people do. I mean, you know this. People are having trouble in their marriages. They buy a new house. They get a new car. And some of you have heard me say this. The worst thing is when they decide to have another child. Because when we get restless, we look outside. And you know, it gets us. It's subtle. Because for a while, it really does calm us down. Until we are living the super-duper-dumb. Until we have to come to the pain part of it. And the other thing is this. It's so subtle that we live lifetime after lifetime with that feeling of, I'm so close. I could almost be happy. You know, and we say, if only. And you could fill in a million blanks. And some of them are very serious. Because when you start thinking, boy, I would be so much happier if only my child didn't have cancer. Or if my child wasn't born with this. Or if my house, you know, we just all got this email about some of us to pray for Esther's brother and his wife. And they, you know, they live in Menlo Park. They run a daycare out of their home. That's how they support themselves. 3 days ago, their house burned down. Mm-hmm. You know, and everything went with it. And that, and you know, when I was saying to a friend who's here visiting me from Boston, I said to her, you know, it's one thing if something like that happens to us. Let's be honest. I am not a very wealthy woman. but I'm okay. I have a roof over my head. I have some savings. And if my house burned down, not only do I have the spiritual wherewithal now to live through that, most important first, but I know how to get a hold of resources. I really have enough money. I'm sure I have insurance. I'm not sure everybody does. You know, whatever it is, we could get ourselves upright again. And I'm not saying Esther's brother and sister probably can do that too, but not everybody can. You know, so it's easy to say, oh my God, our life would have been perfect if only. But we do that in very subtle ways. I just need the right partner. As soon as I can find that partner, you know, I just need the right job. My job would be perfect if only this manager. And we just, it just goes on and on. It is endless. So what Master was saying to Swamiji about these things will fall away, we can never live our lives thinking, I'll go after this problem, this fault, that fault, this fault. They're infinite. They're literally infinite. We have to direct our energy towards the higher chakras. Really, that is how we need to be living, knowing these things and putting whatever effort we can in that direction without being so hard on ourselves that we have to leave the path. And that is really the balance. That's exactly what we're doing. Master said it very interestingly. Master says, we go on and on and on until we come to that place of, what's the word? Monotony, but what is it?
Agonizing monotony.
Then we say, yeah. We say this every Sunday in the festival. We say, this little bird, you know, he's sent out there by his parents saying, do good in the world. He goes through everything we go through. He calls it the revolt. We call it, you know, I'm going to hold on to this. It's mine. It's that. And then, till suddenly the bird realizes, you know, how do I fly in the darkness? How do I? You start realizing, and we say it all the time, that suddenly it comes to us. Until repeatedly we say in the festival, we lost everything we had. Every time I read that, I say to myself, are people getting it out there? Until repeatedly, that means millions of lives, we lost everything we have. Then we come to this place where, we get it. And we think we better move on from the revolt. No? Okay, any comments or questions at this point?
We're motivated.
Yeah. We better be. Because, you know, one of the other things that, I mean, as much as we talk about now, we just don't have to say it later. But boy, does it take motivation. None of this happens passively. That is so important, is that you have to bring all of your willingness, all of your willpower, all of your energy, which we'll talk about when we talk about pranayama. I mean, as much as we possibly can. Again, without feeling that we're going to wind up hating it. That's the worst thing that we could do.
Sure, just a clarification.
Yeah.
So basically, almost everything you're talking about for the last 45 minutes is that study of Shankhya that is,
it is
referred to as preceding the now.
With putting in little aspects of these teachings. But it's getting to that place of agonizing monotony that is really what is Shankhya. Because Patanjali doesn't say to you, this is how to do it. He doesn't give us any techniques. He doesn't even say, this is why you should do it. None of that. That's why he just starts out. Now we've come to the study of the practice of yoga. And what is, I mean, his second sutra that says, yoga is the neutralization, basically, of the vrittis, of these whirlpools, of everything we've just talked about, all of the energy that is stuck in all of these chakras, that it's found its way out there and it's sitting over here just, you know, whirlpools so perfect, running in circles, you know. The second, so he just starts with, okay, we're there, this is what yoga is, it's neutralizing all of those vrittis, and now just let's move on. And then he says, basically, here are the states of consciousness, and here's what you're going to have to do with it. And you will reach this at some point on your spiritual path. He doesn't talk one bit about yoga. He doesn't give us breathing techniques. He doesn't teach us anything about what is an asana. He says to us, what asana is a state. It's a being. It's not a doing. It is that place of perfect stillness. And he talks about it. He says the only way to really know God is to be perfectly still, to be perfectly comfortable in your body. But of course, you know, he wraps it up. He keeps wrapping it up by saying, and of course, to be perfectly still in your body, you have to, you know, interiorize the mind. You can't be restless. If you're restless, you're not going to be still. He just keeps tying it all together. But there's no explanation of how to do it. It's simply the what is. It is really not knowing or doing. It is being. And I think that's what's made it so complicated. You know, I really feel that all of these years, I wasn't ready to know how to be this. I just wasn't ready. And the words just didn't make any sense. Just like they don't when you're not, you know, a lot of my work is coaching people, really, that's what I do. And I just feel like I have to stick to certain principles. And I tell people a lot of things. And you heard me admit just before, not only am I telling them things that I know are an extraordinary stretch. Of course, I'm trying to be careful, because otherwise, if you give them too big a stretch, they just leave. What good is that? You know, that doesn't help anybody. But so where is that line all the time, tuning in to each person, all the time realizing, gee, how's this working in my life? You know, how is it going? But I realize we can only really hear and know what we're ready to hear and know. And it doesn't matter how many ways somebody explains it. It doesn't matter how many times. It doesn't matter. My husband often says to me, I mean, you're getting louder and louder, but it's not going to have me agree with you anymore. Just think, no, if I just say it a little louder, you'll really get it. Because it makes so much sense to me. And sometimes, honestly, I know it's the truth. But it doesn't matter how I say it or how loud I say it. Just like I had an experience some years ago with somebody in the community. I was being asked to move out of the place that I lived in. I had made 5 moves in the community in the preceding 2 years. I was done moving. I had been promised that I could stay in this place for a few years. It was a promise. We didn't write it into a contract, not by the community, but by the people who owned this place that were letting me live there. And I find out, nobody even calls me or tells me, but I find out as I'm listening to some people talk at dinner, that I was going to actually have to move the next week. And it didn't sit very well with me. And I just, to my own credit, it was a number of years ago. But I was angry. And the person who came over to counsel me kept trying to tell me the spiritual reality. Houses don't mean anything. What's the big deal? So you live here. So you live there. You're just so over-attached to this place. I mean, saying it, like, get over it, Shanti. Just get over it. These people are not where you are. They need this house. But, and I just listened for about 30 minutes. And then I said to her, I want you to leave. And she looked at me. I said, really? Out? I said, don't you think I know these things up here? I know them. I can't live them yet. You know, it was so aggravating to me. So, you know, I believe that's why I've not been able to read Patanjali. And I'm certain if I read Patanjali next year or next month, or that I'll look at things and go, oh my God, I didn't see that bit in that little book. I'll just keep getting it and getting it and getting it. Okay, so I think I'll do this now with this book as an A. So let's do, I'm trying to decide, should we take a break and then start and then run through these? Because I'd like to do this board. But I think it's easier if we just start it and work through it than if I just do one and we have to start. So I'd like to take a 5-10 minute break, whatever you need, just to.
Looking at a counterfeit samadhi, all pleasures in the world are counterfeit pleasures.
They are. You're exactly right. All pleasures in the world are counterfeit pleasures. It's absolutely true.
It's like a mere shadow of, you know, where it's coming from. It's like it's come through you, whatever pleasure it is, but it's counterfeit. It's not real. It's the real thing is elsewhere.
That's right. And that really is the whole realization that immediately precedes getting here is, oh, it's never going to happen out there. Yeah, it can only happen in here. But the reflection is subtle. I think with the way you're saying it is exactly right. So where we are now,
Can everyone make one comment?
Sure.
That I heard from another, I heard it from Pandit Rajmani Tugman, who is the head of the Modern Institute. So he was talking at his book launch. He also wrote a Yoga Sutra book. So Patanjali was born to Takshi back in wherever it is in India, and Takshi laid the foundation for the University of Takshashila. Back then that was the Stanford and MIT in those days, where scholars from all over the world used to come there. So she laid the Shila means foundation, and Takshi was her name, and the university was called Takshashila. And Patanjali was born to Takshi, and he's apparently the contemporary of Buddha at that time. I might be wrong here, but it's around the same time when those universities existed, and that there were a lot of things happening with Buddhism and Vedanta and all this, and he came to clear the confusion that, you know, people are saying like we should be ritualistic and somebody's saying something else and all that, and he said like this, all this is happening, and how do you how do you kind of cut through everything and say what should be done or should not be done?
And he writes this.
Yes, and then he writes this. And there are various things said, and you know, people say that he might not even be just one person, because
right,
he might have changed bodies.
That's the point.
So, and then he's a scientist. He's really like a yogi, you know, who's experientially giving out everything. And I think that's what I learned from that talk. So
there's a couple of things about what Kamal was saying, I think. I didn't know, I could not find anything that said exactly even what he wrote, other than people think the sutras, but there was always some question, could they have been written by more than one, other things that had been attributed to him, nobody knew. That didn't matter. But I do think that one of the things that's very important about this is that he came and he just put this out, he clarified it because it was his experience. Because he lived these. There was no question. This was not a philosophy. This was not a thought. He was not in the middle of experimenting with it. That's why I said at the beginning of what I think is important is that every avatar who came after would say the same thing. But if you leave these to the interpretation of everybody who wants to interpret Patanjali sutras, you have to consider the source. Because nobody could interpret these for us who hasn't had the experience. That's why Master could write a poem about samadhi, because he's been in samadhi. We couldn't write a poem about samadhi. It would be impossible. Even some highly evolved souls, people who are much more highly evolved than I am. So I think, in terms of, he came to clarify because he was an avatar, because he lived in that state of oneness. And just like so many avatars come because we need them and they decide. I just heard somebody say in some talk, they even hold on to a little piece of karma, consciously and intentionally, in certain states of samadhi. It might even be in this book, so that they can come back again to help us. They wouldn't really need to come back. But he could write these because, you know, he was the authority, but he wasn't the authority because other men were giving him the authority. He was the authority because he spoke the truth, and when anybody could realize the truth, knew it was the truth. And truth is eternal, and it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks of it. You know that, the examples that Master and Swamiji always use are things like, fire is going to burn you. It's not mad at you, it's not singling you out. The truth is, fire will burn. And you can never make that not true. You can, you might not experience, there are people who can transcend it, these great, great teachers have not experienced, but for most of us, whether we're good people, bad people, whatever. So there are just certain truths, and I think this is what Patanjali did. I didn't know they founded a school about this. Interesting to know. Nina, did you want to ask a question?
Maybe at the end. I don't want to stop your flow. It's about, I was just going to ask, when you said you asked yourself, why is this person in my life, and you know, I'm so upset with her, and so on and so forth. So where do you go from asking yourself that question to the next?
You're asking, yeah. Let's go through these and see. Because you could very easily be wanting a question that's going to satisfy you psychologically and emotionally. We all could. How do I do that? This is yoga is the how. You know, so that's what we're doing here today. And that's why I think, I hope, a question will come. We could sit here and talk logically, rationally. What do you do when a person upsets you? The way the whole world talks about that stuff. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. That would feel good to us. It lets our egos get in there. What am I going to do when somebody treats me badly? There is nothing to do about that. Nothing that will really solve the problem other than transcending your attachment to needing that person to like you, to treat you well, for them to do the right thing. Nothing else ever works. And I mean that. And it sounds so like it's not the answer people would want, but there is no other answer, particularly when we're talking about Patanjali. That's what the class is about. But it's the ultimate truth. There is no way around that. This is the answer right here. And there is no other answer. And we either get it or we don't get it. But even if we don't get it, we'll get it next time. We have a lot more lives, we have a lot more relationships, but it won't change the truth. And this is, I mean, you know, I really mean this because it is the essence of the work I do. And I don't even want to sound arrogant about it because I've been put on this world to help people. It's very clear. I was a nurse, I'm a doctor, I'm a minister. That's this whole life. It's pretty clear what I do. And I've been given a lot of intuition and insight to do that. But I'm living the same life. I somehow see it, and I've been able to care enough about people and touch them in a way that people tend to feel better and learn. But I very humbly, I'm not talking about, oh, you, but not me. But what we all want to do is play with it in our minds a little bit and figure out the justification for keeping things as they are. And it's, people can say, oh, I don't want to do that, but it's so subtle that we all do it. The only answer is to do everything we're going to talk about right now. That's the only way I'm going to effectively move through my relationship with this person that I'm talking about. There is no other way. It doesn't serve me for 1 minute to think about her. So what do? I tell myself, go home and take 5 deep breaths. Bring yourself into your spine. Spend 5 times a day, Shanti, for 15 seconds, sit and bring your attention to the point between the eyebrows. Meditate more. Do more creates. That's what I'm telling you. You asked me what to do. And that's the ultimate truth. And why would we talk about anything less than that here? I have not succeeded. I'm telling you the truth completely. That's not just one person. I just told that story of myself. I mean, why would I do it? But I could sit here and tell you all the ways I'm limited. You know, it's just, I mean, I don't want to do that. I want to focus on the solution. And that's why I said right before the break, there is no solution in trying to go after problem after problem. My brother's this, my sister's that, my friend this, my teacher that, my that. No, it does not work. You do this. It's the only thing to do. And what we're doing as we move here, why we're looking to the how, is we're saying, I'm going to go from this state of delusion, of Maya, that is not as gross as the word sounds. If it were as gross and obvious, none of us would be stuck in it, and there wouldn't be, nothing would exist in a material form. We'd all still be existing as a vibration. But that's not what's happened. We have been materialized from vibration to thought, vibration to thought, energy, form. And we're here. But we're here because we haven't perfected this. And if we had all perfected it, there would be no here. You know, just it couldn't work. But we are here. So, and we're trying to go from that state of delusion to a state of clarity and truth. And the state of clarity and truth, and this is what we'll see very soon now, once you're there, you don't even notice it. It's not that it doesn't bother you. You don't even notice these things. You know, Swami Kriyananda was out for dinner one night with friends. And again, this story has been told many times. And, you know, his disciples were there, and there was somebody, I don't know who they were entertaining. But when they left the dinner, one of Swami's disciples, if you will, I mean, nobody called themselves that when he was alive, but said to him, it was so hard to sit there, sir. That person was treating you so badly. And Swami just said, was he really? I didn't notice. But he was genuine. He had no idea, nor did he want to talk about it or get into it. Because once you have achieved these states, you just don't notice those things. And quite frankly, a lot of these things cannot happen around you. They simply can't happen. And when you get to like where Gandhi was, perfect example, look at what Gandhi did to all of England, for the whole British occupation. I wish I could remember this line that I heard Asha say. Let me just see if I wrote it down. It's adorable and worth looking for, but I'm not sure when I listened to her. I wish I had it. I mean, I don't want to spend too much time, but it was something that she had heard that Gandhi had said, and it's relevant to this. That's why I remembered it being at the bottom of a page, but I'm not finding it, so I'm going to hit one. I don't want to take too much time. But you know, Gandhi basically said, you know, you go through all this, you first, you know, you ignore them, you love them, you do this, they get angry, they hate you, then you win. Because, and what he meant, I'm not quoting it the way he did, it was, but he meant, if you're resting in a place of nonviolence, if you cannot be disturbed, truly, as he could not be disturbed. Because what happened at the end of his life, somebody comes up to him and puts a gun in his face, and he just calls God. He was not disturbed. Then, eventually, you know, that's what he said. Then they love you, then you win. Because it's natural progression. And he knew, as Asha told that story in that class, that he could do that with the British, you know, when he worked with Hitler. But I mean, he could get away with the British because of who they were. But the whole point is, our job is to perfect ourselves in these ways. And then we don't run into all of that. So that's exactly what we're doing. We are really wanting to know, live, experience divine law. That's exactly what all this is about. We've had it. We're done with all the suffering. Let me live in terms of divine law. And what is divine law? I mean, divine law is really love, bliss, joy. It's the eight attributes of the divine. And there's a couple of quotations that I've written in here that I really hope that I get to. But let's start. I wrote the quotations because I knew that I wouldn't be able to remember a couple of things that were just so beautifully said. You know, Master's definition of meditation. But I mean, Master says true meditation. And again, I have the quote, but this is not going to be exactly it. But true meditation, he says, is the single focus, the becoming of having all of your energy so inward, so absorbed, you know, so it's not single-mindedly because it's on mine, but at one with all it is that you become, and he talks about these eight attributes, you just simply are them. And you know, hate cannot exist where there is love. You try it. You try being angry with somebody and awakening, and that's why he often said, and he did, and they're all part of these sutras. I mean, Master came and he taught us his way, but they're all part of the Patanjali Sutras. He said, when something happens to you and you are in a state that you don't want to be in, what do you do when you're angry, when you're hated? The minute those thoughts arise, he said, immediately bring to mind the opposite. Immediately take yourself to a loving place, to a compassionate place, to it, because you can't hold them. You can't be drawing the energy up and have to go down if you're being successful in any way. And you know, sometimes we have to do it the roundabout way. We have to go see a movie that's all about love or a feel-good movie because we're not ready. Even sometimes if you're not ready and you try and put on a chanting CD, but you're so agitated with somebody, it just agitates you more. So you have to say to yourself, again, this is introspection, where am I? What's my next step? Realistically, what can I do? But let's look at these. So these are the Eightfold Path. Remember I said to you, they're interwoven, they're interdependent. It's very important. We're working on all of them. The yamas are the don'ts. So, and they're written as negatives, and I wrote them up here for you. Because, remember what we're doing, we want to be yogis. What Krishna said, Arjuna, be thou a yogi, means be in a state of, because that's what Patanjali is teaching us, yoga. So he's not saying you have to constantly work at being nonviolent. He's saying if you move into your natural state, your natural state is nonviolence. So whatever way we've added the violence on, he's saying, let it go. So that's what these don'ts, that's why they're stated in a negative way. So, you know, the yamas and the niyamas really stand for this kind of right behavior, a kind of moral purity. Moral truth, in essence. That's what they are. That's why Rasha can tell that story that said no matter what these kids did, they could come and they could plug it into one of these. Oh, I see, Mommy. I told a lie, you know? Or, I mean, lying can be not just lying in that way, but maybe trying to help somebody by your thought think that they're less than who they are. That's telling them, that's being non-truthful. It's not just, these are never just the obvious thing. That's why I said I'm just trying to forgive me as I look through these notes to get to some things that I remembered that I wanted to talk about. But let me start with ahimsa, just start there. So ahimsa is not simply, this is why I brought up Gandhi, this complete act of nonviolence. Swami says it's ridiculous. You can't drive your car down the road. You're killing bugs the whole time. You can't walk on the street without killing things. And he also points out, and I think it's very important, that all of this is an attitude more than it is a behavior. To hold the attitude that we will try and control our tendency towards violence of thought, not just of action, but any, or attempting to, you know, we can try and impose our truth on somebody else, that can be very violent. That's what I was saying before in my work, how careful I try and be. It's not really careful, but it's tuned in so that I'm not just trying to push something on somebody that they're not ready for. Because what's the point of that? That just makes people feel badly about themselves, you know? Yesterday I saw a client that the client didn't come, but the family came, because they have a child who's an alcoholic and is acting out and drinking right now. And she's also smoking a lot of marijuana. and the family was enraged about the marijuana. And after an hour with them, I said to them, let's stop here and think about what is our goal. If our goal is to help her get better, and what she's so agitated about right now is that you took the marijuana away, but she's drinking a couple bottles of wine every day for a year, which happens to be, I'm totally not in favor of marijuana. It's a much more harmful drug than most people think. So this is not that I'm in favor of it. Happens to be not nearly as harmful as drinking all of that alcohol for many reasons. We don't have to go into it. But I said, how about if we let her have the marijuana right now and try and talk to her about the alcohol? Because as long as she's just acting out because you stole her marijuana that some doctor in some ridiculous state of non-wisdom gave her, you're never going to get her to listen to you. You're not going to be able to help her with her next step. That was a non-violent, loving solution to that problem. In my mind, the whole family didn't go for it. That's another thing. The father did, but I mean, it's not that it won. But it was actually the perfect solution for her, because we weren't trying to impose our will on her or our reality on her. So you see, that's non-violence. It's not just a physical act. It's so you're not sitting around thinking that you're being a good person, but somewhere in you, you're harboring negativity to somebody. You want them to lose or to look like a fool at times, or you hope they will do something as well as they can. We don't exactly say those words to ourselves, probably, though maybe sometimes we have, but we have thoughts of it. You know, we get competitive. I mean, I'm probably not the only person in the room that it's happened to, but if it's only happened to me, fair enough. But I mean, I know that these states exist in me. That's what nonviolence is. So holding the best of what I started to say to you is that, you know, Swamiji says it's really wrong to kill. We all know that. That's a violent act. Is it as wrong to kill in war? If somebody walked into a school with a gun and was going to kill all the kids in the school, but you had a gun and you could kill him, would it be wrong to kill him? Of course not. You know, so everything is relative and needs to be considered. There is no absolute to these things. It's holding the attitude of these qualities. Non-lying, which is really truthfulness, of course, which is our divine nature. So again, with all of these, we're coming back to what we are to begin with. We're just taking away what really the ego has driven us to do, and the inclinations, and it's not just the ego, but I didn't really talk a lot about chakras, and I don't want to, and the vrittis, I didn't talk a lot about them, but we come in with inclinations, and our inclinations at times can take us, you know, into some of these places. So we have to begin to work on it so it doesn't make us horrible people necessarily, that we're behaving in violent ways or that we lie. We may not actually tell a lie, but if we don't tell the whole truth at times, or you know, pay attention to really what are just the facts of divine law. You know, so it gets much more subtle than what it looks like at first. That violence doesn't just mean physical violence. That non-lying doesn't just mean that. That non-stealing might mean taking away somebody's right to a position at work. But you come in a way that's adharmic and you get the position. Or so it's not just stealing. It's wanting to have maybe something that isn't rightfully yours, when it should belong to somebody else. It's really about coveting. That's really the word that works here. You want something that is not rightfully yours. So when we talk about non-stealing, we're talking about having an affair, or, I mean, you know, things like this that we wouldn't typically think of stealing something in that way, but we are. And in terms of our divine nature that we're moving towards, And when we get down here and we're looking at contentment, because each of these are paired. So non-stealing and contentment can be paired. And non-violence, and they don't always work in this order, but non-violence actually can work in ways with cleanliness. It's also paired sometimes with austerities that we have to do. So again, they work together. They're not simple black and white things. But so non-stealing has to do with contentment. There are ones who do and ones who don't. You know, what does it mean? I remember years ago I had a magnet on my refrigerator that says, contentment is the realization of what you already have. Because it's true. For us to think that anything should be in our lives that we don't already have, whatever it is, it's wrong. It's a wrong thought. It's not the truth. Master always said, what comes of itself, let it come. Now, this is all assuming that we're on a spiritual path, that we're working towards being better people, that we're doing our best to think good thoughts, that we're inviting whoever it is that's your master, that you're inviting the truth in, that you're asking for God to come into your life. None of this works if that's not the truth. If you haven't gotten to that place of agonizing monotony, you're not looking at all, any of these. So, I mean, that's an important difference. It's not, it doesn't mean to be lazy, you know, because laziness comes up there under one of the obstacles. It doesn't mean you just lay back and say, okay, God's going to just take care of me. I mean, quite the contrary. We have to bring an enormous amount of energy into our lives. We have to make sure that we're standing in the right place for these things, for God to be able to work through us and or for us, you know, to them who could receive him, to them give you the power to become the sons of God. And what does that mean? To be ready to receive divine intervention, divine law, divine guidance. And what happens if you get guidance that isn't what you wanted? What happens when you're sitting in hell wanting to really be mad at somebody? You know, and I'm using it because it's in my life right now. And I keep hearing, Shanti, this is not the way out. You're not going to get anywhere. You are spinning your virtual wheels. You can make as good a case as you want. Get over it. You start bringing love to this situation. That's what you have to do. And it doesn't mean you have to put yourself in danger. It doesn't mean you have to decide that you want to, you know, love doesn't mean let's go out and have lunch every single day. It doesn't mean any of that. It means an attitude. It means opening the heart. It means holding that everybody in that place of, I'm going to quit doing you harm. I'm going to quit being so violent, and I'm going to quit telling untruths about you in my head, telling myself that you're less than perfect. You're no less perfect than I am. I mean, they're all subtle, but they all work. Non-sensuality is, you know, it's really brahmacharya. But it's not simply, I mean, the hardest part of this for any of us is, of course, sexuality, our sexuality. Master speaks a lot about this because, you know, it's such a draw for us as human beings. I mean, for the vast majority of human beings, you know, it always intrigues me. I watch a lot of these nature shows on television because that's all I'm willing to watch. So when the time comes, if we want to sit down and relax and watch TV, that's typically what I watch. I am absolutely amazed at how strong the draw for a partner and for sex is in every animal that's ever, ever shown these. I mean, it can be a bird, it can be a worm. You know, I was walking the dish the other day. This is true, and it really helps me understand who we are as human beings, because we've evolved. There were a couple of tarantulas up on the dish where I often walk. And, you know, they're really fascinating, but, I mean, they're such clear beings. They have legs that are like this thick, and they're covered with fur, and they're beautiful and scary. But there happened to be a man up there who knew a lot about tarantulas. I was up at the top of the dish, and he says, oh, yeah, these are Australian. He started talking to me. And he said, they will walk back and forth across this concrete path that you walk on that, when you walk the dish, as many times as they have to, back and forth and back and forth, till they find their mate. They know who they're looking for, and they're always the males who are doing this. And I thought, dear Lord, I hate you. Now, of course, I'm up there walking the dish too, so I wasn't going to get mad at the tarantulas. But I mean, it's such a drive, and it obscures, in many, many instances, our ability. I mean, not only is sexuality driven from our lower chakras, so when they're out of balance, you know, we want to have more sex, we have sex indiscriminately, we think it will bring us a kind of peace that it will not. I'm not saying that sex is bad. That's not at all the point here. I mean, sex in the right circumstances, and, you know, truly, it got to be called making love at some point. But we all know it's not always that. But so I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not making a case against it. I'm saying it has people behave in mindless, unconscious ways, and it drives people to do things that get them into a lot of trouble. As a physician, I have heard more people than I can tell you say to me in my office, I don't know what happened, I found myself in bed with him or her. And I think to myself, what does that mean, you found yourself in bed? You know, really, what does it mean? It means I was driven, I wanted to have sex, I found a way to get unconscious about it. Either shut off my mind, or I drank enough, or I took enough of, I did whatever I had to do. That's really acting through compulsion, not through clarity, like we were talking before. That's on the opposite side of what we're talking about. But all of our sense pleasures are that way. If we're not working at all to control them, and they all fall into sensuality. So if we have no control over what we eat or when we eat it, or, you know, any of the senses that drive us to want to do things. I mean, I think people who just travel incessantly and they can't, now I need to see this, now I need to do that. And those are sense pleasures, you know, and they're out of control with them. It's not making a conscious choice, a conscious decision. So it's not simply about sexuality. But I think it's easy to see that. And
all compulsive pleasures.
All compulsive. Yeah, that's the perfect phrase for it. All compulsive. Yeah, and they are. But again, of course we have to eat. Most of us have to eat. But I actually eat. I feel very empathic with people who are, I mean, I feel the ways I'm caught in a lot of these things. So, you know, and I mean, food's one of them. I could just, I love to eat, and I don't always love to eat good food. So, I mean, I can really, you know, when I worked, I did a lot of work with addicts and alcoholics, and I remember this very clearly. I've told this story before. One day I was in Draeger's parking lot, and I was going to go shopping for dinner. Buy food to make dinner. And I sat in that parking lot because, you know, I've always been wanting to lose 5 more pounds. My whole life, if I was 5 pounds thinner, everything would be perfect. I sit in the parking lot and I'm saying to myself, don't buy any snacks. You're about to walk into Draeger's. For those of you who know, really hard not to buy any. Everything looks beautiful. No snacks. You're buying dinner. You're going home. You're going to make dinner. You do not need to eat in the store. I mean, I literally said those words to myself. I walk into the store, I buy a bag of pretzels, and I start eating them. Now, are pretzels terrible for me? No, that's okay. But I said to myself, because I just come from work, I said, thank God this isn't cocaine or heroin. You know, because it's the same thing. And I felt such a wave of compassion. You know, I should have felt more compassion for myself. I didn't, but I felt it for my patients. Okay. Greed is really, once again, wanting things that don't belong to you, wanting more than what you have already. Again, that thought that you should have more than what you have or something other than what you have. Again, all of these things lead people to compulsive behaviors.
It's different than
different than stealing. It's
so
different. Let me see if I can. I'm going to tell you.
Wanting something not mine.
Stealing is wanting something not yours, and greed is wanting more of what you already have.
Yeah.
I knew that Swami made it an important distinction.
Or be attached to what you already have.
Yeah, the attachment. Thank you for saying that, Birosh, because that is really important. Again, remembering that a lot of these are not as much definitive points on a line. It's always directional on the spiritual path, and the bottom line of everything on the spiritual path is not attachment. You know, I don't know this because I did not listen to the lectures or read the lectures. I guess I can only read them that Master gave on Patanjali, but somewhere I heard that he gave about 42 lectures on Patanjali. 10 of them were on non-attachment. I mean, it's huge, so I mean, it's really important that you brought that up and said that. So again, often it's the state of mind that we're in with it that matters here a lot. Let me just get to one place so that I can make sure that I'm not leaving anything out that Swami said that would be really important about the yamas. I just want to see. He just so succinctly in this book makes such brilliant points. Yeah. So he says very clearly, over and over, he says, it's in one's attitude that can either lead him towards liberation or hold him in greater bondage. I mean, those are Swami's words, and it's just so. So an attitude of harmlessness and its corollary, a feeling of universal benevolence. And that's what really gets important when you want to be mad at somebody or if somebody actually really is treating you badly. The point is not to try and make them your best friend, but to find that place of benevolence in your heart, because that's what you need to grow. It's not even about them, though it will serve them, but that you cannot move forward until you do that. Swamiji even talks about with Ahimsa, he talks about killing somebody's enthusiasm about something, you know? And it's very interesting when you think of how easy it is to just cut off an idea that somebody has or... it's so interesting. It just came to me. It just came to me this very minute that that's a lot of what my family did with me. They didn't consciously, they were not trying to harm me. But everything, you can see I'm somebody with a lot of enthusiasm. I was told over and over, you can't do that. You'll never do that. Why would you want to do that? I heard that over and over. Really, it's by God's grace alone that I just left and did everything I thought I wanted to do. But I was told constantly that I couldn't, as in you are not able to do things, which is so defeating. And it is an act of violence, so you can see
how it doesn't work.
This is very interesting what Swamiji says about non-lying. He said, truthfulness is the necessary attitude if we would overcome, this is so important, our own false notions about life. Our path to God is entirely a matter of ridding ourselves of our delusions. He talks about that with non-lying. So non-lying means all the ways that we don't own our true relationship to God. I mean, it's probably Penn's ultimate degree of subtlety. But this is what I mean about how Swamiji writes. And an untruthful person, he says, is always wishing that his life were different. He puts that not just like I'd like more in terms of greed, which it is, but I wish my life were different, because he's not being truthful, saying everything I have right now, every circumstance, everything is perfect. It's perfect. I mean, it's so huge to get that. This is my karma. It is not a mistake. There cannot be any mistakes. And Swamiji calls it non-lying. I don't know if I'm saying it clearly or not, but it's just so profound. This is why I wanted to look back at this book. He says another very important thing about truth. I meant to say this. He says truth is always beneficial, but he says to make harmful statements to somebody, to be so truthful with them, like to say to somebody, God, you look like you've gained a lot of weight. And they have gained a lot of weight, but who wants to hear that? You know, why would you say it? So it's not untruthful to not say it, right? And he's saying, truth is always beneficial, but you don't always have to verbalize it. You don't always have to share everything you see as the truth. And he says, an attitude of truthfulness, I just say this, is to, I numbered these because this is how, to always see things as they are, to accept the possibility that one may be mistaken, to entertain no likes or dislikes that might prejudice you in your perception.
Right.
Yeah, I know. There's all spiritual path again.
Yeah, right.
This is why it's so hard when I felt so overwhelmed about doing this. In 3 hours, I thought, this is what we've been studying our whole spiritual path forever. This is all. And fourth, truthfulness means, number one, to look always for the divine light that shines in the midst of universal darkness. Number two, to see God in everything and everyone, because this is the truth. This is divine law. This is what it is. But you see how far. To affirm goodness even in the face of evil, and yet always to do so from a center of absolute honesty, never of mere wishful thinking. These are so profound. But I just want you to hear what's even in. This is why, I mean, just to say again, you can see that there's nothing. If you really could hold all of this, I mean, I personally would have to keep this book open with my kids. But you know, there's nothing that goes on in life that you can't bring back and say, okay, where are we out of tune here? Where are we not being one of these things? Where are we doing something that we shouldn't be doing or not doing the dues here? Everything, every single thing in life. He says non-stealing means coveting his property. I mean, I think we talked about that. And this is a very interesting point he makes about stealing and being covetous. Because that's it. He says, it takes you constantly out of the moment. Desire only keeps one looking to the future for fulfillment, he says, instead of realizing the perfection that is. And he calls that stealing. Because you're stealing the moment of perfection from yourself. I mean, it's by desiring anything else to getting out of the moment. Now again, I just want to say, this is what it should be. This is what we're talking about. We're talking about yoga. And we all know that we're on our path there. But this is the cream of all of this. This is the thing. This is Patanjali. It's just every single thing is the essence. Swami's not using a lot of words to expound on it. He's using his words to show us this is what Patanjali meant in one sutra.
Yeah.
That's it.
One half sentence.
Right, exactly.
All these
in
concepts
one,
were included.
Yeah, in one half sentence. Okay, and then brahmacharya, I really think we talked a lot. Swamiji talks about when we get very sensual that we're dulling our awareness. And I think that's right. I think that's why we are sensual. That's what happens. You know, it happens a lot with alcohol. I mean, if you want to have a drink or you want to have a hit of marijuana, or again, I think sex is a big, you know, you just calm yourself with it. And I think calming ourselves means, in most instances, decreasing our awareness. There's so much in here, I could just stand here and read you this book, but I don't want to do it. It's interesting. He says two of the primary requirements for enjoying life to the fullest. So he's still talking about non-sensuality, but under that are the preservation of one's inner energy and its upward direction. And he says these are the most basic requirements for spiritual advancement. I mean, we say it all the time. How many times do we say in and up instead of down and out? And it makes sense at so many levels. But when you read Swamiji saying that it's the most basic requirement for spiritual advancement, you think, of course we say it. We have to keep saying it. We have to keep reminding ourselves, because nothing's going to happen without that. And he talks a lot more about that, which we won't do. He does say, any sense pleasure that does not heighten a sense of universal oneness, but that tends to emphasize our consciousness of egoic separateness from other beings, can be classified as sensuality. That's how he describes. It's actually a brilliant definition of sensuality. Any sense pleasure that doesn't heighten our sense of universal oneness. Because he has said in here, there are things that happen with our senses that take us closer to God. But he's saying now, anything that doesn't can be termed sensuality. And I just think it's an amazing, yeah. Okay, then let me just move on here too. Just want to see. I know the important thing he said about non-greed. So he just says exactly what you said, Bhakmajodhi, what we knew. But non-covetousness, huh? That's hard to say, which is really non-stealing, has to do with wanting something that belongs to somebody else. But he says the minute you want more than what you have, you are completely out of tune with the divine. The yogi should realize that everything is God. Greed or attachment limits the mind to one body and obscures the truth that the soul is, in essence, infinite and eternal. I mean, it's really interesting. It says if you want more, you're forgetting who you are. You remember that story of Nandamon Ma, where somebody was concerned about something that was going on politically. I think it might have been during the Second World War. And he was saying, Ma, can't you do something about this? You have to intervene. I know you have the power to do something. And she just sat there and she looked at him. And, you know, I never met her. I wish I did. But, you know, you just feel what she was, pure love. I mean, just a manifestation of pure love. And then whoever was telling the story said that she looked at this man with such love and said, do you think for even a minute that God who created this world doesn't know how to run it? Like, how could you think even this impending World War II could be outside of divine perfection? It was such a profound thing that she said to him. And, you know, I mean, I think it's really important when we talk about greed that way, even though it's so subtle, because we're saying to feel greedy ever means that we're not in that moment of realizing exactly what we already have. So anytime we think that we want more or we need more of, I mean, again, I want to be careful. If somebody doesn't have enough to eat, I think this is why, this is an interesting thing. You know, Swami always quoted that study where he said they did a study with people on how much money they had, because everybody always said they could really be happy if they had, was it 5% more of the rush or something? It was something. A majority of people in this big study said if I had 5% more, I'd be happy. But the other part of this study, or another study, and these were, I mean, you know, statistically significant, acceptable studies, said that once people had food and shelter, that in the vast majority of instances, more money did not make people more happy. That getting more, once you have food and shelter, and I think that really makes a very big difference. I mean, if you don't have a roof to sleep under, or you can't eat, or you're hungry, or your children are hungry, you know, very hard to be at peace. But so I think, you know, that when he's saying this whole thing about, you know, the perfection, and really, I mean, here's the truth. Nothing falls outside of the karmic law. Nothing. So if you're there and you're starving and your children are starving, you know, that was always an interesting thing for me in India. I haven't been in India now in about, I don't know what it's been, maybe 6 years. And I think things are changing very rapidly. And the last couple of times I was there, they were changing.
But I think the blue tarps are still there.
They are. But, you know, you watch these people who are physically, what's the word? You know, they were born with a lot of deformities, or they just look like they're hungry. And, you know, they often have their little kids out there with them. I mean, you just see it everywhere. It's very common. I very often, I don't want to say always, but very often when I was in India, felt that if I made eye contact with a lot of those people, we both knew the truth, that they had an acceptance of this as their karma, that we as Westerners would go over, and people would say to me all the time, how can you want to go to India? How can you look at all of that need and poverty? And I kept thinking, you know, it's not, of course, there's enormous poverty. I mean, there's poverty here too, but it's just so in your face in India. It's hard to get away from it. It's just, but, and it's extreme. It's really extreme with these villages that are set up with rags, and, you know, anybody who's been there knows what I'm describing. But it just never felt as awful. It felt like somehow, I don't know if it's just in my mind, but there was more of an acceptance of it because people knew about karma. They knew. It just felt so different to me. So I want to be careful. I don't really know if I can know what I'm talking about, but I do feel ultimately nothing falls out of the realm of karma. So if you're there and you're living under a rag and your kids don't have enough to eat, that too is karma. It doesn't mean you shouldn't try and do better, but there's no mistake here. So none of this says sit back and accept it and don't do anything about it, but it also means do it with God, do it with thoughts of God, do it by, you know, because this is the other side of that that's important. It's, we come in with karma. We come in, we're predestined in each lifetime for certain things to happen. We just are. But we can overcome our karma. That is a big part of what free will is about. But there's other ways. If we could never overcome any karma, we'd never make any progress on our path to God. So we have to believe that we can grow and overcome this karma. And that's where moving up the chakras and really being strong, rooted, fluid, owning your power, offering that up into your heart of devotion, I mean, continuing to move forward comes in. That's what neutralizing these vrittis means. And that is moving through karma. So is that clear? Am I saying that clearly? Okay. So, now, let's just move on. Anybody want to make any other comments right now?
Well, that thing you were saying about telling somebody that you put on a lot of weight. So, you know, whenever I have to give somebody the truth, you know, my checklist of that is it non-violent. So if it's going to hurt the other person, and then you still want to say it. And it's given the right sequence, the yama, you know, the first thing is non-violence, and then comes truth.
Right.
So it's like, if I come and tell somebody like you, put on a lot of weight. So, you know, the first thing is it non-violent or not?
Yeah, that's a very good point.
So you have to balance it there, like, okay, maybe if it is violent to a certain extent, but is it good for the person? And in the larger context, it's non-violent or not.
So the order is important, too, of those.
Yes. I mean, that's how I have interpreted it.
I think Kamal's making a good point, though. It's not...
Yeah, I think the order is not... said anywhere. I mean, all of it holds good, but I've always seen it like, oh, you know, non-violence has been mentioned before.
It helps you remember the priorities, those two.
Yeah, so it's a very good thought to hold. Anyway, and I think that's when, you know, Swamiji makes a lot of those points, like you don't have to tell, you should never tell anybody anything that's only going to hurt them or do them harm. What are you just going to say, Swamiji?
I was just noticing that I've been working on these for a while, consciously, but I was just noticing I have recently took a trip with my daughter, which was an unusual thing to do, to a very outward materialistic world and place, New York, And when I came home and people have asked me about the trip and my experience, I described it in each one of the yamas. I described the yamas. It's just occurred to me because what I would say is that I saw all this around me, but I didn't care about it or covet it. I was like using those experiences, and I realized it was the most joyful trip to this. So not me, but so I experienced such joy. It was because of the yamas.
It's so beautiful. I really know, and it's just where you've evolved to. And it is so free. You don't have to be drawn into
everything.
Every single thing you're saying, I mean, I really understand it. You could probably go through them.
I didn't wish it was different. I didn't, it was just all those things. It's just so amazing what peace this brings.
Yeah.
That's a really...
To an experience.
That's a great story, actually. I'm sure that story that will come up in other classes because it's wonderful. I mean, New York City is probably the quintessential center of materialism. Well, Ram Dass always used to say, this is an interesting thing, I had this thought this morning, he used to say, if you're really a highly evolved yogi, you could sit down at the corner of Fifth Avenue and 52nd Street and meditate, right, of course. And he said, you could meditate there. And I always knew what he was saying, but I always noticed that he didn't do that. I mean, it's not like, and that's important, right? You don't necessarily want to go there to meditate, but it is beautiful that you, I mean, I hear what you're saying. It's very touching.
Consciously experience, though.
Well, that's something that it was Asha quoting somebody lately. You get in these places where the whole energy just seems to be, by me, take me home. And that's what cities do.
But you could be in the middle of that and be at your center.
Yeah.
That's what came out.
Well, what you're saying that I mean, of course, I'm thrilled for you. I mean, it's the truth because, it really is a sign of being spiritually involved to not be being tugged on or put off by that, which is wonderful. But I also love that you're just saying in this class and pointing out that there's nothing of life that we can't approach by asking ourselves honestly, am I living in terms of these? Which is exactly how this class started by saying Patanjali came and he gave us, here's the absolute bare bones essence. These are the stages you'll go through. This is what it is. When you get to this where you're really not coveting anything, you are not tugged on, and no matter how aggressive or whatever somebody gets with you, it just won't bother you because you have no desire there. Nor will you even need to be irritated with the person.
So,
and I'm also thrilled to hear that you were on a trip with your daughter.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
That's another story,
but I love it. Yeah. All right. I would love to go through these, just even, we'll do it in a superficial way by the time we get there, but because they really tell a story and they bring it all together. But it's so easy to just spend time with the yamas and niyamas. I think because, there's so much to talk about in our own life. There's so much to talk about them, and just because of what Atmajyoti was just saying, all of a sudden, and you just have that awareness, right?
Yeah. Yes. Just sitting here. I mean... That's obviously why I came to the class.
Hey, I'm glad it happened. We only had 30 minutes left. Okay, so the niyamas are the do's. These are the things that we have to consciously be doing. And I'm going to do the same thing I just did, rather than just try and give a few examples. I'm going to just briefly run through, because I do have stars next to every great point that Swamiji made. And I think it gets so subtle. He does such a great job. But the first is cleanliness. And he says it means not only physical cleanliness, but I want to say that it does mean physical cleanliness. People who live and put their places a mess. I used this before because I've heard it, I'm sure it's in here, about nonviolence, that if you create huge mess and you can't keep order, but, you know, I mean, and it's on a continuum. Some people are pathologically, you walk into their house and it just looks like, you know, somebody just ravaged them. So not that, but anyway, that keeping a kind of order allows us to work in a certain kind of way and be in a certain kind of way. This is a very interesting thing, and it also just came to me, but for years I've done a job in medicine where I use different offices every time I go to work, because I don't have an office where I work. I just go in a half a day a week and I'm put somewhere. And the nurses know there are certain offices they cannot put me in, because those doctors' offices are so chaotic. And I say to them, I'm not going to be able to practice good medicine in here. It's perfectly clear to me, but I could not, my intuition will not work as well sitting in there. I mean, there's old food that's sinking into the computer, that, you know. And interestingly, I have begun to notice that it is these doctors that leave their jobs more quickly, or in certain cases have been asked to leave. It doesn't surprise me, not just where I am now, because I'm not casting aspersions, but over time. Because otherwise, I've watched doctors, they have, I don't want to scare anybody, but, you know, they get to the bottom of these, not just piles, not even just a neat pile. I have a lot of neat piles in my house, but crazy piles, and there's somebody's EKG that was abnormal from 3 months ago. You know, you can't, I mean, these things happen. You just, you can't be like that. And you're not a calm, open channel then for intuition to flow, which for me is all of how I practice medicine. I mean, not all, obviously, I know some medicine, but, you know, the intuition really plays a role. So I think this idea of cleanliness and nonviolence, it just, it's just an example of how it gets in. But interestingly, where Swamiji goes with this interpretation, a heart cleansed of attachments, this is how he talks about cleanliness, a heart cleansed of attachments and the vain preoccupation of a worldly mind. Isn't that interesting? I mean, when he's talking about cleanliness. So he's saying basically, he's saying, Patanjali is saying, you know, that we're clearing, we're taking all of our likes and dislikes, which is what he goes on to talk about, and we're transforming that into devotion. And he calls that, like, he doesn't say this, but like cleaning house. But the point is that it's real, so that, and I mean this, Apajyoti could come back and say, you know, I wasn't attached to anything there. I felt, and you might not have called it cleanliness, but it, but Swami does, that's how Swami interprets it, and it allowed you to move on and have the perfect experience.
Oh wow, that's totally within.
Yeah.
That sentence.
So, again, I mean, because we wouldn't call it that, and yet truth is truth, and truth is eternal. And if it's cleaning up, it's cleaning house, but not both in a literal and in a figurative and in an energetic, and we could say, in a an astral and a causal way, that you could take it right through every one of these states of being. And in fact, you have to, because it gets more and more subtle what cleanliness means as we're working towards these higher and higher states. So you have to think of it on every level. But who would have thought of this if we didn't have Swamiji interpreting this? The heart of man is impure when it longs for anything that is foreign to its own nature, which is another interesting thing. So the issue of when is dirt dirt? When is dirt dirty? You know, dirt is not dirty or wrong if it's at the farm. Right. Or if it's, you know, but if you trace it into your house, it becomes dirt because it's not meant to be there. But it's, so it's not an exact snapshot of a moment of time. It's what is this whole picture and what is foreign to our nature. So when it's foreign to our nature, then it's, we're not being clean. Okay. we can't take too long on any one of these, or we won't get there. But this is very important, though. This is what Patanjali says. Patanjali says, he doesn't say it, I mean, in these words, that for perfect cleanliness, listen to this sentence, this is the essence of this. For perfect cleanliness, there arises a consciousness of freedom from the body, a disinclination for its pleasures. From a place of perfect cleanliness, that means impure thoughts, that means likes and dislikes in the heart, everything, again, that means that's our true nature, that we clean up till what's left is our true essence. And he said then we have a consciousness of freedom from the body and its inclination for its pleasures, which are not necessarily, that comes under non-sensuality. But do you see, I love the word, you know, the word that Swami's used, the two words he uses a lot are inclination and disinclination. It's such a gentle, loving way to put all of this. I mean, it really grabbed me as I was reading this. He even goes on to explain why he used the word disinclination, but he says here, which is very interesting, he said Patanjali's actual reference was to the fruits of cleanliness. And you know, he talks here, and this is really the way I think of it, it says, he talks a little bit about watching the company that we keep under this concept of cleanliness. Mm-hmm. And even in terms of what does it mean to accept hug, I'm a completely hugging person. Everybody in this room almost, except you, knows this. I hug everybody. I mean, I don't hug everybody, but I love to hug when it feels right. But he talks about who do you hug? When you hug, are you discriminating there? What about handshakes? How did it come to be in India that people do a namaste instead of shaking people's hands? What does it mean? It's not about it. It's not because they're physically dirty. That's not what we're talking about. But from a vibrational, energetic, subtle level, keeping ourselves pure. Isn't that amazing? He talks just really about that, about the vibration in things. So where do we take ourselves? Who do we take ourselves there with? What does it mean to go into a noisy restaurant where they're playing rock music? You know, in this sense of purity of vibration. Purity as a substitute is a word for cleanliness. He says a lot more, but I'm going to move on to contentment. And he says here, and he said, Master often said this too, that contentment is a supreme virtue. And you could really see why, because if you've achieved contentment, and that's why I brought to mind that little magnet that I had, the realization of what you already have, it means there's no wants, no desire, no likes, no dislikes, no restlessness of the mind or of the body. You are contented. It really implies resting right in every moment where you are. I could see why he said it's a supreme virtue, because more than any of these other ones, as I was thinking about it, and of course I didn't think of everything, but I could just tie it all, you know, tie it all together in such a beautiful way. He says here, joy cannot be found by merely waiting for it to come. And just listen to this, how he says it. Because it is like the realization of what you already have. That's one way of saying it. But he says, joy is always right now. And he puts in that one, these capital letters. I mean, it's just, even if you just said that to yourself over and over, joy is right now. Nothing needs to change. There's nothing that has to change. There are these false notions that we have. Everybody in this room has had this experience. You know, you've had the experience of somebody doing things to you that is really aggravating. And then you probably have the experience of people doing things that are out there in the way, but they're not touching you. I mean, it's really what you're describing. It can't touch you if you're not there. If you're in your center, it can't touch you. And no matter what they're doing, it doesn't matter. They can be calling you names. I mean, if you're a saint and you're walking, they can be throwing stones at you. And you get home and you say to your disciples, oh, the children wanted to have so much fun. They were throwing stones at me and calling me names. It's joy, you know? The children were making fun of him and being mean to him. It's not his experience. He is in joy. Joy is always right now. I just love that.
I was sitting on a bench in Central Park by myself and just really enjoying everything. There were all kinds of things. But out came this biggest rat I ever saw.
Uh-huh.
And then I just looked at it, and the people next to me looked at it. And then mama and some babies came. And then down the way, three or four all came like that. It did not change the way I was feeling. I didn't feel, anything other than what was there. And therefore, I had a nice experience.
Yeah. You know, I want to just appreciate that loud that you're sharing this, because, one of the things I think is that we may not be able to get all of this, but we can enjoy and appreciate and be uplifted by the vibration of these teachings, as Master sharing them with us, Swamiji sharing, even if we're not living them. But we can be changed by the vibration and magnetized and drawn. And I feel that way about your sharing, because it's such a perfect moment that I literally could feel my own heart opening. Because that's what happens around truthfulness and around purity. It just does.
I went right back to the trees and the little breeze and there was a pond, and it just didn't matter.
When you enjoy, you can't be touched by anything that might have been called something else.
Yeah.
From that other state.
Yeah. So they work. they work. It's kind of like, wow, it works. Mm-hmm. The teachings.
I just know right where you are right now. Mm-hmm. Because there's such simple words to say, but when you really get it, it's like, and you just, this is all the truth.
Yeah.
This is really the truth. There is no truth is truth. There is no other truth. This is it. And when you live it, that's where you go. And it's so simple. You feel silly saying it, but it's such a celebration to realize it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Tapasya is really, as Swami says, not a popular word in the West, because we think of it as austerity, which we don't like here. But he says he says there is a certain amount of sternness, seriousness, commitment, austerity that is absolutely needed for us to be able to go from an outward pulling direction out into the world, noticing what is, coveting it, wanting it, being affected by it, to coming and into an inward direction. That it takes a certain degree of not just energy and willpower, but a kind of austerity to get there. And so he makes sort of no bones about it. And he's saying every act needs to be that conscious, that deliberate. I mean, I think deliberate is probably the main word. And he's talking about it, not just about out in the world, but he says, what about when you sit to meditate, to deliberately bring your mind in, like to think of it. I think it's a problem for Westerners because we don't like that thought of power. I feel this often when I teach the chakra class. People have a lot of trouble with the third chakra because everybody wants to think the spiritual path is just so sweet and nice and you just live life and do good things. But he's saying here, Patanjali really means to be deliberate. He says always harmonious, and it doesn't need to imply anything about a grim attitude. In fact, one can be deliberate and a little austere and partners end up with a joyful attitude. Yeah. Okay. Self-study is really self-awareness. I think in a way we've talked about it a lot, because it really means being in the moment, looking at yourself, noticing who you are, where you are, not just in this moment, but ultimately when you take this to its natural conclusion, that we are part of the infinite. I mean, that's really what Patanjali meant by it.
But yes, self-study.
Yeah, but there's all of this is a continuum.
What did you say?
Big yes, self.
Oh,
big yes, self, yeah.
Oh, biggest.
But you know, here's the thing, and I'm just watching the time, so I want to say this. At some point in the Raja Yoga book, or maybe it's in the Patanjali book, I don't know, I just got confused, doesn't matter. Swamiji very sweetly at the end of all of this that we're talking about, which is really, again, it's challenging. He says every bit of this can be applied to everyday life. Here's your story, which I don't want to take anything away from. It's extraordinary. Probably was not samadhi, though.
No.
You were not in samadhi. You were actually very present in Central Park and at 5th and 52nd. I mean, just whatever's going, and as you say, there's a lot going on in New York. So I wouldn't take anything away from it, so we're applying it. Where are we right now? There's a way to bring all of this there. So it's not, I have to say, because I want everybody to see what Patanjali meant. Patanjali meant self-study with a big S. I am one with the infinite. But that doesn't mean anything to us. That doesn't help us, just repeating that. However, to stop and ask ourselves, where am I right now? Who am I? Where am I going? What is my next step? The ways that we can apply it. And Swami lists, I'm not going to get there, we're not going to talk about it, but all of these ways that all of these, not just the yamas and niyamas, but all of this can be applied to our everyday life wherever we are. So he said, just make no bones about it. Take what you can from this and live it the best that you can. And he says that. But this is really a movement towards self-awareness that's growing, that's expanding, that's having more and more realizations of the true, our true self. And then devotion to this, to the Supreme Lord. Again, these are the dues. Really, he's talking about devotion, and he's saying no one can rise spiritually who doesn't first of all have it in his mind that there must be something higher. But really, as Sri Yukteswar said, and you know, you cannot put one foot in front of the other on the spiritual path without opening the heart's devotion. And of course, that has to be true. I mean, we know it from the chakras. We're talking about energy flowing, we're talking about Kundalini rising, we're talking about making it to the point of the sixth and hopefully in some lifetime the seventh chakra. I mean, so it's got to be getting to the heart and offering everything that happens in our lives where we are to the Lord with that ultimate understanding that at some point we will, you know, what's the saying? Love thy neighbor as not as thyself, but because they are thyself, because we're all one. And I think really ultimately that's the goal of this, that we're not, it's not me offering God my love, you know, because ultimately there is no I. So this is why Master said true meditation is having oneself in a place where you are the eight attributes, because then we are love. And I just want to read one thing that Swami says. So he's just saying, I mean, I hate to say this, but he's just saying what I just said, because I'm saying what he said in my own language. It is only an effort of the heart to lift itself up into that consciousness where divine love is felt and known. He says, Patanjali says that by supreme love, one enters upon that ray of divine love on which the infinite consciousness forever dwells. I think that's so beautiful. Okay. Now, I want to go backwards. We have 10 minutes. I just want to go through these. So we're just going to come back now. Well, we're not coming back, really. What we did is we just went through the first two limbs of this Eightfold Path. And I just want to touch on, I think we're all aware, it took Asha 2 years, what can I say, on any one of these, because you see, it may just get progressively more subtle depending on where we are, where our consciousness is. But I just want to mention them, and in the way that Patanjali presented them. So when he talks about, remember, he's talking about stages of spiritual development. I keep saying that because it's not a practice. And I think with asana and pranayama particularly, we can get confused. Because in our minds, so often, asana means a practice. But it doesn't mean a practice to Patanjali. It means a state of being perfectly still. That's what it means. It's saying one cannot know the divine, one cannot have one's consciousness be raised, expansive, blending, partible, if one is not perfectly still. But it takes not only a straight back, straight spine to be able to bring everything into what is called the sushumna. Remember, I talked before, the irida and the pingala, there are energetic currents running, but to really come into the very core of our being where we're one takes a perfectly still, a state of stillness. So Swami does say it means that you should be able to sit perfectly still for 3 hours without moving a muscle. He says that. But that's not really all of it. It's a state of much deeper stillness. It's an attitude of stillness. It has to do with stillness of the mind more than anything. The next stage is pranayama, and this is another place where we've been taught that we think of pranayama as breathing exercises that we do to control the breath, because the breath will control the energy. So we thought of prana, at least many people here, as breath. But prana is the energy, and Patanjali goes so beautifully. I'm going to invite everybody, now that we've even talked, just a little bit we've talked. If you own this book, open it up. Don't read any of Swamiji's commentary. Just read the sutras. Just go home and read through them. It is amazing how much more sense they'll make. So, just because we've been talking about it and holding it where we have. But the word prana really refers to the energy itself. So it is true that we can control some of our energy with breath, but we're also controlling our breath with energy primarily. That's what we're doing. We hold it backwards. Now, it's true. If somebody gets upset, I had a friend who I was on the phone with last week, and while we're on the phone, a couple weeks ago, her dog got hit by a car, and she got so hysterical, I didn't know if she was having a stroke or a heart attack, and I kept saying, are you okay? No, she screamed, I'm not okay. I couldn't even understand her. Finally, I had to scream into the phone, stop, breathe. And I could hear her, breathe again. There was nothing else I could do. She was in Oakland, I was on the freeway, so I could just hear what was happening and help her. But it was amazing from a place of pure hysteria. As soon as I said, use your breath. And I think it's really good for all of us to remember, and Patanjali saying it, this is why we control the breath, because it's very, in a very subtle way, it's linked to energy. But mostly what we're doing, mostly what pranayama is controlling the energy actively, because if we're not controlling it, everything we do becomes unconscious. And that's really the bottom line. We're controlling our energy to keep ourselves in a state of supreme ultimate consciousness. So it's not the techniques he's talking about, and I think that's where we go wrong. But he's saying the control of the energy can be achieved as a result of those techniques. We know that, but that's not what Patanjali is saying to us. Okay, so Swamiji says, his word signifies a state in which energy in the body is harmonized to the point where the flow is reversed. And it's just what we say, but do you hear how beautifully said that is? Energy in the body is harmonized to the point. So again, same thing, instead of down and out, it's in and up. But that we have to harmonize the energy before that can happen. We have to have control of and be allowing the energy to flow. We have to be in a state of consciousness. We have to be still enough. We have to be inwardly interiorized enough with our mind, which is the next limb, pratyahara. It means interiorization of the mind. So he's saying, you cannot have this energy be where it needs to be, which is, again, kundalini rising up the spine. If your mind's out there, if you're restless, if you're thinking of this and that, if you're not in a state of perfect stillness, everything has to come together in this place for all of, for us to be in the state of consciousness, which is samadhi. That's not even so simple because there are so many types of samadhi, but we won't even talk about that right now. That's the fifth state. The sixth is dharana, which means really contemplation, which means to be so fixed on an inner awareness. So now we have our mind interiorized and we are contemplating, it would be ultimately the point between the eyebrows. We would, that's what would be happening here. You know, Jyotish said in his talk, we all start in different places. We can contemplate, and Jyotish frequently advises us to, master's eyes. You know, hold an image of the master. Contemplate his eyes. Don't let your mind wander, pratyahara, anything from those eyes, and stay there, dharma. Okay, so brought in, contemplating, and then the seventh stage, which is dhyana, meditation, complete absorption in that which we are, really, but in the divine. Complete absorption. At this point, you are not contemplating anything. You understand? There is no more I, thou. There is, at this state of dhyana, really, duality ceases to exist. When we move into this place of samadhi, we then expand from that energetic place to become a part of all that is. I know these are just words and we're out of time, but I had to run through this, you know, because none of it makes sense without the rest of it. That's where I got today. I just suddenly saw it and understood it as such a whole that it wouldn't be right. You know, the yamas and niyamas, yes, we would practice them and apply them everywhere. But I'm just going to give you, this is the last thing I'll do then. Well, I mean, anybody can say who has questions or thoughts. But I just want to show you this. I'm just going to do this a little bit for you and show you how beautifully these read. Patanjali says, of course, and now we come to the practice of the science of yoga. Yoga is the neutralization of the vortices of energy. Sorry, that was a good statement. Then, spiritually free, the sage abides tranquilly in his inner self. So when we've achieved this state of neutralization, the sage abides peacefully, tranquilly in his inner self. Otherwise, if one hasn't found inner peace, the vrittis cause the indwelling self to assume many outward forms. There are five classifications of vrittis. Some are painful, some are painless. The vrittis are right and wrong conceptions of what is. imagination, sleep, and memory, all frittis, in stirring the waters of feeling, distort the reality that is soul bliss. Now, I'm going to stop here, but doesn't that just make perfect sense now?
When you get the context, all of a sudden...
And it's so beautiful just to read. Yeah, and you can read the whole book that way now. I mean, it's wonderful to read Swamiji's interpretation because, I mean, I tell you, I just say this, whether I should or not, but the longer I live, and the longer I live on this path, it's crazy. I can hardly say Swami's name without wanting to cry. I feel such a state of awe and gratitude, and I never understood this. I've spent decades in gardens, how many lifetimes, and then Swamiji comes, and all of a sudden I'm just reading Patanjali, and it's so beautiful. Oh, I see that. Of course I need to do that. Those darn vrittis in this land. I mean, it's just amazing to me that I could wake up and experience such joy this morning reading this book. And I do want to say, I mean, it wasn't that it was silly to try and teach this class in 3 hours. Of course it wasn't. It's, I think, been a lovely and uplifting morning. And I personally had the joy of everything I felt I needed to do to get here. You know, but these just are truths to be contemplated and studied forever. And I hope, you know, that everybody, me included, you know, can take the time and go back and listen to Asha's class. Asha has a beautiful way of speaking. She, it's not quite free association, that's not what it is, but she just goes and
she weaves.
So really the point of the talk can be in the last 10 minutes, but the stories, fortunately, are always delightful and fascinating. So, I mean, that's why it took 2 years. It didn't take 2 years because it had to take, but it's Asha's way of teaching, and she's one of the best teachers at Ananda, so it's beautiful. Clearly helps people understand and everything. But just listening to the talks, I imagine as you drive around, you do whatever you do, because she does go through every one in a kind of deep and great detail, actually. But I hope that at least I've been able to share some of the joy of these teachings, really. That's what I decided on my way in here is, look, if you can just help everybody feel great about Patanjali, it's enough. So, anybody have any comments or questions? And whoever needs to leave, please feel free to leave.
Well, I do have a related comment, that the next course that I teach happens to be on the Bhagavad Gita. And what you just did in the last 5 minutes, so, you know, let's remember, let's go back to what the original words are of what Patanjali was saying, and let's see if they make sense now.
Perfect.
That's the whole point of that next class on the Bhagavad Gita. Because, no, we don't have to go through all the commentaries and all the intellectuality and all the jnani intellect of it all. We have to change our level of consciousness so that the words of the original sacred text actually gets into us and we get it.
That's very well said. That's beautiful. Because you're usually a 3-hour class.
Yeah, that's all Swami ever wanted us to do,
yeah,
is to get ourselves to a point where the text makes sense to us.
Yes.
The original text.
It's wonderful. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Were you reading from a specific chapter or it's like spread across the
book? Well, you know, I read that book. I listened to talks. I have a lot of notes here. But when I was just trying to quote Swamiji, I was reading from the Raja Yoga book. There's a book on the one chapter on the sutras, one chapter on the yamas, and one on the niyamas.
Oh, it's
in the Raja book.
Oh.
Did you do all of Raja Yoga?
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. Good.